Coming up, as South Africa celebrates the World Cup tournament, Desmond Tutu looks at his nation since the end of apartheid, its present troubles and future possibilities.
I've always said I'm not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope.
Plus, what one poet found in the Book of Psalms.
The Psalms are full of longing for God.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, with many religious leaders in the audience, President Obama delivered his first major speech on immigration reform since he became president. He called for legislation that would punish employers for knowingly hiring illegal immigrants and would offer immigrants an earned path to citizenship. The president acknowledged the coalition that has formed among religious communities.
People of different faiths and beliefs, some liberal, some conservative, who nonetheless share a sense of urgency, who understand that fixing our broken immigration system is not only a political issue, not just an economic issue, but a moral imperative as well.
Following the president's speech, religious leaders gathered in front of the White House to pledge support for comprehensive reform.
We call on Congress to do the right thing.
Throughout July, religious communities will hold prayer vigils, fasts, and rallies to protest Arizona's immigration law that goes into effect later this month. At her confirmation hearings this week, U.S. Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan faced questions about her views on abortion, same-sex marriage, and the separation of church and state. But when pressed by senators, Kagan offered little insight into how she would rule on the proper relationship between religion and government. If she's confirmed, hers would be a crucial vote in religion cases, which often split the court. The Supreme Court wrapped up its current term this week with a 5-4 ruling in a case closely watched by religious groups. It pitted a publicly funded law school's policy of no racial, religious, or sexual discrimination against a Christian group's claim that it should be able to discriminate regarding its members and their beliefs. As Tim O'Brien reports, the law school won. If a group there discriminates, it cannot receive public support.
The court ruled that the University of California's Hastings College of the Law could deny funding and access to school facilities to the local chapter of the Christian Legal Society because the chapter denies voting rights to students who refuse to embrace the group's religious beliefs, which include opposition to sex outside of marriage and same-sex marriage. Lawyers representing the Christian Legal Society had asked the court to rule that that violates the chapter's freedom of religion and freedom of speech.
What we're talking about here is the ability of a group to preserve its message. And it doesn't make sense for a group to, for a public university to say to a private student group, you have to give up your Christian faith in order to get the same privileges that other groups have.
But dividing 5-4, the Supreme Court sided with the law school. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg writing, the law school's non-discrimination requirement is a reasonable condition. The Christian Legal Society is not entitled to a preferential exemption. Justice Samuel Alito led the four dissenters. Brushing aside inconvenient precedent, the court arms public educational institutions with a handy weapon for suppressing the speech of unpopular groups. I do not think it is an exaggeration to say that today's decision is a serious setback for freedom of expression in this country. The court's majority was heavily influenced by the law school's claim that its non-discrimination policy was not just aimed at discrimination based on sexual orientation, but that it was against all discrimination. The defendant in the case, Dean Leo Martinez, said under the school's broad policy, a Jewish student group would have to admit Muslims?
The short answer is yes.
A black student organization would have to admit white supremacists?
It would.
Even if it means a black student organization is going to have to admit members of the Ku Klux Klan?
Yes. There's a Spanish saying to the effect that the thinnest of tortillas has two sides. And the other side of that is that any other regime, we would be forced using public money to subsidize the discriminatory practices of a particular group.
Justice Anthony Kennedy, who provided the crucial fifth vote, said the outcome would have been different if the Christian Legal Society could show outsiders were trying to infiltrate the group to stifle its views. And all nine justices agreed the chapter will still have a case should the university apply different standards to the Christian Legal Society than it does to all other student organizations. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien at the Supreme Court.
Religious groups had mixed reactions to the court's decision. Some, especially those that support gay rights, praised it as a blow against discrimination. But others worried that the ruling could hinder a religious group's ability to define itself by its beliefs. Several faith-based groups that receive public money said the decision should not be allowed to affect their right to hire only people who share their beliefs. The Supreme Court also said it will not take up an Oregon case about whether a victim of clergy sexual abuse can sue the Vatican. The Vatican appealed to the High Court after lower courts ruled that in this case, the immunity law for foreign states does not apply to the Holy See. The Vatican argued it is not liable for the actions of abusive priests because, it said, priests are not its employees. With the Supreme Court's refusal to intervene, the case will now proceed in a district court. Along the Gulf of Mexico, bad weather from Hurricane Alex hampered oil spill cleanup efforts. Meanwhile, faith-based community activists met with government officials to demand more support for residents who've been affected by the crisis. Local religious leaders say hundreds of fishermen, particularly in the African American and Vietnamese communities, still have not received any outside help. In Pakistan, more than 40 people were killed and nearly 200 were wounded after suicide bombers attacked a popular Sufi Muslim shrine in the city of Lahore. No one has claimed responsibility, although Islamic extremists often target followers of Sufism, the mystical strain of Islam, believing Sufis to be heretics. As the World Cup soccer playoffs approach their end in South Africa, Fred DeSam Lazaro sent us a special report from Johannesburg. He notes the many disappointments since a democratic government replaced the apartheid regime in 1994. Riches for a few, but also widespread crime, corruption, unemployment, and what's been called the worst income inequality in the world. Fred also spoke with retired Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who acknowledged his country's failures, but still spoke of hope.
South Africa has spent $6 billion just on stadiums, money that could have gone to many pressing needs in a poor country, but that debate has been put aside for the celebrations these days. No one, it seems, has escaped World Cup fever, not even Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who came to our interview wearing soccer vestments.
Many of those were celebrating are the very ones that you would have thought wouldn't, I mean, because they are poor. But, you know, the scriptures long ago reminded us that human beings don't subsist only on bread. You need things that lift your spirit.
For five decades, Tutu has been one of South Africa's most prominent voices, a leader in the struggle against the white minority rule of apartheid, leader of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that is widely credited for a mostly peaceful transition after elections in 1994 brought the long-imprisoned Nelson Mandela to power. Now frail, the 92-year-old Mandela makes only rare public appearances. Tutu is also retired, but he keeps a much higher, often outspoken profile.
God gave us an incredible start with Nelson Mandela, and it would be very difficult to maintain that quality of leadership.
After 16 years, the verdict on democratic South Africa is decidedly mixed. It still has the modern infrastructure built for its affluent 10% white minority. What's new are places like this glitzy mall in the historically black township of Soweto. Not long ago, the only blacks in places like these would have been cleaning them. Today, few people can match the consumer appetite of people like Tim Tebela, part of a new class of black industrialist. He recently came to the site of a multi-million dollar home he's building near Johannesburg.
I mean, we're still waiting for the Italian chandelier to come in that you chose.
Yeah.
And I think it weighs, what, 1.5 tons?
Yeah.
Tebela was a young member of the African National Congress, or ANC, that was banned for fighting apartheid, which officially excluded the 85% black majority from all but the most menial jobs.
So help me God.
All that changed after ANC leader Nelson Mandela's election in 1994.
My business career in 1994, I can say, has improved dramatically.
Tim Tebela is a natural salesman who quickly found success in the insurance business. By 1995 came more opportunities.
I then established a company called Tebela Building Construction. Now, that was also in response to a new trend in government in terms of trying to empower the blacks.
Tebela is one of the most successful beneficiaries of new sweeping policies to increase black participation in the economy, more ownership of shares in industry, affirmative action in hiring, and more government contracts. The problem, many experts say, is that such success stories are all too few. The new policies have many more people feeling hurt rather than helped. Kuni Creel has spent 4 months scouring the internet for a new job.
A lot of the adverts is stipulating AA, that stands for affirmative action. So you immediately knew that they prefer the AA candidate.
The 45-year-old mechanical engineer was laid off from a mining company in February. 4 years ago, he left a previous job after being passed over for a promotion. In both cases, he says, affirmative action considerations may have hurt him, even though he's not entirely opposed to them.
You're getting the phases up and down, then you feel, why me? But then you realize that that's basically life. And between myself and my wife, we believe that is the way of the Lord.
And overall, Creel has reason to be optimistic and confident. Despite government affirmative action programs, white South Africans are doing well. White unemployment is just 5%. And given the shortage of engineers, Creel is confident he'll soon land a job. That confidence is hardly shared by blacks. Although living conditions have improved somewhat among black South Africans, black unemployment is officially 25%. In reality, it's likely much higher. Unlike their parents, young blacks like Nontokozo Kubeka can visit shopping malls, but many can do little more than window shop.
I think the problem in South Africa is that we have the most brilliant policies, but they're on paper.
She got a government loan to attend college, the first in her family ever to do so. But the 24-year-old political science major hasn't found a job 16 months after graduating.
The situation is, you are more likely to succeed if you know the right people, if you were in the struggle for some reason, you know. I'm too young to have been in the struggle.
South Africans of all races complain about corruption, about high crime rates, about an education system in decline. Amid all this, amid political scandals surrounding the extramarital affairs of current President Jacob Zuma, the ANC has continued to win elections, still trading, experts say, on its reputation as the party of Mandela. Archbishop Tutu says it will soon have to respond to growing discontent among voters. He's urged the government to harness what he calls unprecedented national unity leading up to the World Cup.
I haven't seen so many people displaying our flag on their cars and every conceivable place. It's just a fantastic, thing, and we're enormously grateful that it is there.
Are you optimistic that it will re-energize South Africa? And if so, what gives you that optimism? You've expressed some reservations about the ability of this government to deliver the goods.
I've always said I'm not an optimist. I am a prisoner of hope, which is a different kettle of fish. Optimism is too light. Now, to come to your question, I think, I mean, that they do have amongst the cabinet the people who are strategizers, people who are aware that there has been a kind of disillusionment amongst the people. I mean, they've seen the protest demonstrations because people are upset, I mean, at the slow delivery of services.
Do you worry about the aftermath of Nelson Mandela's passing?
It's going to be a horrendous moment in the life of our country. But human beings do have a capacity for adjusting. But, I mean, we're going to become a normal society. And we will not always be looking to Colossus to lead us.
At the end of the day, Tutu said he pins his hope for South Africa and for the world on what he called humankind's intrinsic goodness, the subject of a new book he's co-authored with his Anglican priest daughter, Impho Tutu. They argue human beings are hardwired to do good.
Fundamentally, we are good. When you see a good person makes us feel good too. We felt good just watching a Chinese student standing in front of tanks. I mean, and knowing that he was not likely to succeed in stopping the carnage. But for a moment he did. I mean, he made those tanks swerve. And looking at that image, our hearts leapt with an exhilaration that said, yeah, that is how we should be. That is how I would hope I would respond.
You've written that evil will never have the last word.
No. Sometimes it takes long.
What is the terminal point
where
you say the last word is being uttered?
For the ones who are suffering, it's forever, it seems. But happen, it will. Just ask Hitler, just ask Mussolini, just ask Amin, just ask the apartheid guys here. Yeah, they used to strut around imagining they were totally invincible. You say, where are they today?
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred de Sam Lazaro in Cape Town, South Africa.
There's a new book called The Complete Psalms by a Boston poet and writer named Pamela Greenberg. She's Jewish. She says at a dark point in her life, she found so much solace in the Psalms, she wanted to translate them from the original Hebrew into poetic language for people of all faiths.
I began the translation at a very dark time in my life. I came to religion as an adult really as an act of desperation. You know, I felt I needed to believe in something, and I struggled with depression. I had an intuition that in the Psalms I would find something of the relationship to God that I was looking for. The Psalms are full of longing for God, you know, a longing to experience God more intimately.
My shepherd.
I think mostly for Christians, the Psalms represent exactly what they do for Jews, which is the person of faith standing up in relation to God in a very honest and genuine way. And I think in that way they speak to all of us. The great thing about the Psalms is they address really the whole spectrum of human emotion, from intense despair and feelings of abandonment by God, feelings of betrayal by humankind, fear of mortality, to great joy and jubilance. And when I walk through the valley overshadowed by death, I will fear no harm, for you are with me. In translating Psalm 23, I was very aware that it is a psalm that people are most familiar with. And so I wrestled with it. It seemed to me to be a psalm that addressed the fear of mortality. And it's about death, but it's really about, it's for the people who are living. And it's also about the kind of spiritual death that we experience in our lives, a distance from God. The Psalms are very important to people who are suffering, because illness can leave us feeling very distant and cut off from God. And for people to feel that there's a way to talk to God, even from those periods of intense, almost unbearable torment, was very transformative. To my mind, anger at God is a part of religious life. In Psalm 39, for instance, the psalmist is saying, I am getting ready to walk away from you. My interaction with you brings only pain and sorrow. You know, answer me before I leave. And to me, that's religious speech. I did wrestle with, I would say, particularly with the concept of the enemy in the Psalms, Psalm 109, verse 8, which is a psalm that wishes destruction upon the enemy, and in very vivid terms. And that kind of thing terrifies me. You do find within the Psalms wishes for revenge upon the enemy. In my understanding, those expressions are really meant to diffuse the kind of human anger that we experience by articulating them, by placing that revenge in the hands of God rather than in human hands. The Psalms are very much concerned with justice, while at the same time looking around the world and seeing the injustice of the world and crying out to God, saying, you know, God, you who created the heavens and earth, why can't you create justice on earth? The Psalms that praise God are also important because they situate joy within the context of a relationship with God, which makes joy more than simply moments of happiness within a person's life, but it sort of gives joy a more of an eternal context. The ending of the book of Psalms is a crescendo of praise. You know, the very last psalm, Psalm 150, praise God with cymbals that ring loudly. Praise God with cymbals that come crashing down. Let everything that breathes praise God. Shine forth your praises on God.
On our calendar this week, members of the Baha'i faith commemorate the martyrdom of their founder, the Bab, who was executed in Persia July 9, 1850. Baha'is suspend work on this day. And also this week, Muslims celebrate Laylat al-Miraj, marking the time when they believe the Prophet Muhammad miraculously traveled from Mecca to the site of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem and then ascended to heaven for one night. Finally, South Africa may have the World Cup, but China is boasting about the world's first ever religious games. The communist nation has long been criticized for repressing faith, but its official news agency says China celebrates religious diversity, hence the religious games. Buddhists, Taoists, Muslims, and Catholic and Protestant Christians battled it out in a series of competitions. There was everything from ping pong and Chinese chess to basketball, cycling, and even tug of war. The Chinese news agency did not report who won. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more from Archbishop Desmond Tutu on South Africa and from Pamela Greenberg on the Psalms. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available, and you can always follow us on our Facebook page. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you this 4th of July weekend, the Navy Band in New Orleans performing last Sunday at that city's Trinity Episcopal Church.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.